If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi. My name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in Food podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Zach Froelich about his book, From Label to Table, Regulating Food in America in the Information Age, which is out from the University of California Press in 2023. From Label to Table is a biography of the nutrition facts label that adorns millions of food products and has become an integral part of the food and information landscape in the United States. The story that Froelich tells unfolds in part as an institutional history of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, which is the agency responsible for the label. And it uses the agency as a way to understand the ideological and policy debates about responsibility for communicating scientific information to the public, from regulation and gatekeeping to information brokering and nudging. From Label to Table is the story of how the American contemporary food information environment emerged out of the history of transformation from paternalism to informationism. Okay, Dr. Froelich, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us. And also, sorry about the we had a little trouble with daylight saving, figuring out the scheduling here between the US and Europe. I appreciate your patience with that. So we're gonna be talking today about your book, From Label to Table, which is a dual history of food labeling and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, in the United States. And you call it a biography of the food label, which is a really sort of compelling way to phrase that. And you show how the regulatory role and the communication strategies of the FDA have changed over time. So how did you get interested in this project?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on here. And also, you can just call me Zach. So I actually got interested in the project because of a personal reason. Years ago, I had a friend visiting from Europe, and she was in my kitchen looking at food products, and she saw a package, and she pointed at the nutrition facts label and said, "This is so American." And you know, we didn't talk about it much at the time, but I knew exactly what she meant. I think there were kind of two aspects of it. One is it seemed really scientistic. Europeans always laugh at kind of the diet fads that Americans have, and a lot of them are about the latest science and, you know, eat this food for that reason and this health claim. And, you know, Europeans also have their diet fads, but are, you know, see themselves as having a more rooted food culture. And so there was a little bit of that kind of science obsessed American aspect of it, but also it was the kind of black box. And we're also infamous in Europe for being legalistic, and they imagine us as very litigious. We put a label on the banana saying, be careful not to slip on this kind of thing. And so there's a sort of way in which I think she was responding to both of those aspects. And so after that conversation, I just started thinking, I was like, you know, it'd be interesting to figure out the history about this nutrition facts label. And when I started working on that paper, very quickly I realized, okay, there's actually a much more interesting, longer backstory. The nutrition facts label gets introduced in the 1990s, but the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has been worrying about these issues for decades. And so part of it was driven by that kind of interest in the nutrition facts label. The other thing that happened was I was trying to learn about food law, and I was a student at MIT, and you know, not far away was Harvard, and it has this law school. So I was like, I will audit a food law class at Harvard. And it was taught by Peter Barton Hutt, who anyone in food law knows is one of these giants in the field. And taking his class, I met with him one-on-one, and I said, oh yeah, I'm working on this history of nutrition labeling. And he looked at me and he said, oh yeah, I'm the reason why there's that. And I remember thinking, you know, really, you know, what was that? And apparently he was at the Food and Drug Administration in the 1970s. And that was a turning point in the book when they introduced nutrition labeling. So in that sense, what he said was true. And he then said, you should come down to my law firm in DC. He works at Covington and Burling, which is a big law firm. We have lots of archives and you could use those. And it turned out, I spoke with a FDA historian at the time, and she was like, oh yeah, their archives might be bigger than ours for this kind of stuff. And they just had lots of materials about sort of how the firm handled health claims, you know, the problem of nutrition labeling and advertising. And so that was helped me get kind of the backstory, was looking at those private archives.
Yeah, which is, it's an incredible story and a fantastic opportunity for a historian to have access to such incredible materials. Also, I just wanted to say on a personal note, you know, your story about the sort of litigious American you know, image that we have reminded me of when I presented some preliminary research that I was doing about food education for children in Japan. In Paris to a French audience who generally seemed shocked and horrified that you would treat food as nutrition and not in this sort of holistic way. And I was thinking that, you know, it's interesting that the Japan has a very sort of similar, for you know, some historical reasons, sort of scientistic, as you put it, you know, approach to food and this sort of food labeling and breaking everything down into, you know, macronutrients and all that sort of stuff is something that I recognized. And it was one of the things that interested me in getting into the book is thinking about how that as a sort of communication strategy emerges in this long history of the FDA that you're telling in the book. And, you know, you're talking about the ways that this reflects broader changes in the political economy of food in the U.S., for roughly the past century or so. And along the way, you're taking on a lot of questions about expertise and public trust, about the dawn of the information age and informationism. In order to sort of get at some of those issues, I want to ask you to unpack a passage which comes from the book that I think will help the audience to get into that. So you write, the 1990s Nutrition Facts Panel was intended to be an extended cognition aid for the distributed consumer. More recently, policymakers have embraced choice architecture and built food policy around a rationally irrational consumer who acts on emotions and irrational behaviors, but in predictable ways. These nudge policies are justified by substituting a libertarian paternalism that protects individual choice and lifestyles for the much maligned old-fashioned liberal paternalism. So in other words, I think what you're saying here is that since the 90s, we're kind of living in that world of the book nudge, the choice architecture and liberal paternalism, but that this is really just something from the 90s and that there's a long history behind that. So I wonder if you could maybe unpack a little bit of that to get us started.
Yeah, no. So first of all, this passage has a lot packed into it. And I try really hard through most of the book to avoid compressing so many sort of high-powered words, and this is a passage where I don't succeed at that. But it is true that it it does speak to one of the big questions at the center of this history of food labeling policy, which is how much can experts or the people designing these labels trust the consumer to know what to do with the information that's put on the label? And so one of the things I do in this book is I talk about how the way the experts imagine these consumers has changed over time. And in the early years of the story, which really starts in the 1930s, the people working in the agency, the sort of predecessor of the Food and Drug Administration, what they referred to as the ordinary consumer. The idea was they're developing consumer protection policies related to the ordinary consumer. And they had a legal concept like the reasonable expectation tests that start to get developed in a lot of legal literature and in court cases. And there were different ideas about who was the ordinary consumer for which product. So they understood that people tend to be more credulous. They talked about the credulous consumer for health products and diet products. And so they needed to make more of an effort for those products to make sure that the kinds of claims in advertising around health products were policed and such. But for the ordinary consumer, they felt like the goal with food was, you know, you need to make it self-evident and fit with what the ordinary consumer expected it to be. And some of that was focused on the rational choices that an ordinary consumer might make about price or quality. But you also have this idea that there might be hidden desires. A lot of marketers, especially after World War II, are focused on the kind of like, what are the hidden motivations for the consumers? But for the FDA, this meant that the goal was you need to make a kind of simple food system and then separate out the sort of drug and health products from that, where you need to be more careful. As the story moves forward, they start focusing more on the idea that there are active consumers out there who are seeking information. And so I talk about the informed consumer as the kind of imagined model they have. Again, I'm not talking about what consumers are doing and saying in the book so much as how experts are imagining them and then why they use that to justify their new policies. So by the time you get to the 1990s, where I'm talking about in this passage, the distributed consumer, the irrationally rational consumer, you have a lot of different ideas of how consumers work, but it's no longer the idea that there's sort of the single person who has simple needs and the label is going to solve that. The distributed consumer, I get this from studies in science and technology studies looking at how we use computers, is the idea that when you're flipping through different windows, you might be completely different in how you're behaving as a user on your browser, right? And in a way, the FDA has a similar idea of the 1980s and 1990s shopper, right? When you're a mom, you're in one mode. When you're thinking about your own needs, you're in a different mode. And when you're buying the snack product, you're looking at a product one way. When you're buying components of a meal, you're looking at it differently. And so suddenly they're making this kind of food label with this idea of this distributed consumer. Again, there are these kind of cycles in how experts think about the consumer that go from the kind of focus on a rational user to this irrational user. And by the 2000s, you have behavioral economists, you have policymakers, Thaler and Sunstein have a book out called Nudge, who start to say that, hey, consumers do all kinds of crazy irrational things with the food label, but they do it in a really predictable way. And so they use this phrase, rationally irrational consumers. And they use that to justify the idea that, hey, it's not just about equipping the consumer to make rational decisions. Actually, they're delegating to us, the expert. And what we need to do is steer them in ways that recognizes that they don't have a completely rational view of what's going on, but steer them in ways that then fit with our, you know, policymaking. And this is the nudge model that the book kind of ends on in the conclusion, saying this is the kind of current model that you see. So for me, it's not so much that I'm adopting any of these particular models. What I'm saying is that there's this kind of interesting evolution and a lot of conflicts among experts about who is the consumer when we're designing these labels.
Yeah, and so this is a history, a story that begins, as you said, in the 1930s. And that's very much the topic of chapter one, about the sort of age of standards, as you put it. And you know, I think you've addressed some of the most important ideas in there already. And I just so maybe it makes sense to really push us into the post-war, which is the era of information, the 1960s, which is very much more the subject of chapter two, where going into the 60s, you know, the American diet is rapidly changing, industrializing, and in this context of change and innovation, the FDA and the consumers that it served are sort of swimming upstream against all of this scientized advertising, which you've talked a little bit about. And in response to that, the FDA, as you put it, emphasized the need for expert gatekeepers to shore up professional standards, right? So we're still sort of in this standards model to some extent for drugs, et cetera. And in chapter two, you show how the agency is attempting to navigate its role as the regulator and the arbiter of scientific truth in this new age of diet foods and fads and so on and so forth, and what Harvey Levinstein dubbed negative nutrition. So can you tell us about this era? Because I think in some ways, we talked about, you mentioned the 70s being that real turning point for the agency. And it seems to me that the 60s is a really important run up to that, where the challenges that are going to cause that revolution are mounting up.
Well, yeah, one thing I hope readers today will get excited about in this book is that they're going to see this period in the 60s and a lot of things that are going to look really familiar. These kind of health claim advertisements about food, regulators sort of, shaking their head saying, what do we do about this? Companies being slick and taking advantage of it. But then there's a lot of things they aren't going to recognize. This is the period where people haven't yet fully adopted this emerging model that food has this kind of risk-based diet concern. And this is this, and I'll talk about this in a second, but this is the beginning of a new kind of risk-based model about preventive health, where diet and food are really important to that. And so you have, experts and medical professionals saying, well, this is, problematic. We need to keep this to patients in a way that will look very different. To show how far we've come on this, in the 1990s, there was this big change in the United States where you have direct-to-consumer advertising on prescription drugs. And we're one of the few countries in the world that has this. So if you're anywhere else in the world and you come to the United States and you see an advertisement on a prescription drug, it's just a very weird thing to watch. And we're now used to this. So when I speak in the United States about this, I have to really kind of denaturalize that because it's sort of the extreme opposite end of what I'm describing in chapter two of what's going on with food. So first of all, I just want to say, this is very much a book about the United States, but a lot of it that's, I think, informed by the fact that I've lived abroad a lot. And so I don't take for granted this kind of American approach towards food and health because of that time living in other countries. One of the important ways the FDA attempts to regulate markets in the 1960s is by shoring up a clear division between food and drug products. And what they decide is, okay, for food products and the ordinary consumer, we're not going to allow health claims because that's just scaring them. And this is a response to a long history, along with the medical association, of trying to police nutrition quackery and medical quackery, where you have these non-licensed doctors selling all kinds of things. And so they're saying, we're not going to allow this. But for drugs, obviously we will. But then because we're concerned about the risk, we'll really emphasize the rules about prescription drugs. And there will be a clear expert gatekeeper, the doctor and the pharmacist, as well as the FDA in terms of pre-market approval, to make sure that these things are understood and are safe and are worth it in the special case of patients. Okay, so this is the kind of concept the FDA has. Falls apart with diet food products. And they have a kind of middle category of special dietary foods where since the 20s with insulin, you have diabetics who need sugar-free foods. They're now living longer lives and they need sugar for food. So the FDA understands this. So it assumes that doctors and these diabetic patients will understand that artificially sweetened foods are necessary to them, even though the FDA is concerned about the risks of these artificial sweeteners and these additives. But companies are playing with this. They're saying, hey, there are people who are interested in artificial sweetened foods for lots of reasons beyond just being sick. Clearly vanity dieting being a big one. The FDA is really unhappy about that, and for like a decade resists efforts by advertisers to kind of sell sort of direct to consumer advertising for this food, saying, look at this kind of opportunity, calorie free foods. So in a way, there's this kind of cat and mouse game in the 1960s with advertisers and the FDA on this. I will say that it's easy to read this as a story where industry is undermining good faith regulation. But it's not that simple. And where this is really clear is with the diet heart thesis. In the 1950s and 60s, some researchers start to really push the idea that the rising rates of heart disease are partly because we have this, you know, affluent diet, you know, fatty foods, eating too much. And we need to start changing our traditional ideas about food. And part of that is saying if we have low fat foods, a lot of the animal fat foods that used to be highly valued, you know, meats and dairy products, now they're saying maybe we need to find alternatives. And so there's this kind of undergoing debate. Initially, the FDA looks at this as like another fad diet and says, hey, doctors might have this conversation with their patients about this, but we don't want this out in the public. But of course, these sort of progressive doctors with this diet heart thesis are saying, hey, this is different. We need to start pushing preventive health concerns, right? Even healthy people today in the future might be sick if they don't make changes to their diet today. So this is not just about doctors and patients now. And so there's this real debate that the FDA eventually changes its policy on and says, okay, actually, maybe we do need to start accepting certain kinds of health information out there for even healthy consumers. So you have a wide variety of products. For some of them, the FDA is really unhappy. Artificial sweeteners is a kind of clear in the 1960s. They have lots of concerns about, are these carcinogenic? Clearly fine for patients who are concerned about more immediate health concerns, but maybe not good for widespread use. But then they have things like vegetable fat margarines, where, you know, they're kind of behind the medical profession, who's saying, hey, you know, olive oil, this is good. These sort of vegetable oils and products might be good for people who are concerned about heart disease risk. And it leads to two big problems. One of them is they've been penalizing companies that make non-standard foods with this label imitation. And food industry is frustrated because it's trying to create lots of new products, including low-fat foods, and those low-fat foods are starting to be called imitation foods. And so you have these political cartoons where the food processing industry is complaining that one day they'll have to market the superior imitation margarine, right, and get people to think that imitation is actually better than the real thing. And the other are the special dietary foods. So they're trying to establish rules about a wide variety of markets, especially vitamin-enriched foods and supplements, low-cal foods and low-fat foods, sort of clear rules about this, but they're getting pushback from all these different industries because they feel like they're being held back by the food standard system.
Yeah, and so the rest of the book is going to treat the 70s to the present and sort of the response to this, you know, crisis moment that's cropping up in the 60s. But I did want to say, I mean, I think your point is very well taken that a great deal of the material that you're treating in the book in the context of the 1960s, you know, we have the echoes, the sort of the sense of repetition now, you know, in the age of Ozempic on the one hand and freakouts about, you know, is aspartame going to cause cancer actually after all these years? Maybe it's actually a carcinogen. Now there's, you know, the anti-seed oil people and, you know, all these same questions. But, and this is, I think, the sort of interesting turn that you make in chapters 3 and 4, in a very different sort of regulatory and ideological kind of environment. And so since the 1970s, you know, FDA food policy, as you show, has been more about labeling than about regulation in a sort of direct sense, right? And this is, you know, as you describe it, it's kind of a neoliberal turn, which, to use your words, is moving the responsibility for food safety onto individuals. And so chapters 3 and 4 are looking at this point of crisis for the FDA, where, you know, around the turn of the 1970s, and how the agency deals with that, and enters a, you know, a period with a new vision of the market, which centers on the informed consumer that you've mentioned. So you write that this is a shift which parallels two modes of governance that are the focus of this book: standards of identity and informative product labels. So what does that mean, and for especially for the politics surrounding the FDA, and what are then the downstream effects that it has on consumers?
Yeah, great question. So chapter three is kind of a weird chapter in the book. It stands apart because in the first two chapters of the book, all of these debates may be about the consumer and they may be about the public and dieting, but the public is really not there. In a way, it's really lawyers and physicians and regulators at the FDA who are having these kind of, you know, backstage conversations about the American food consumer markets. And in chapter three, that changes because there are a series of sort of public relations crises that the FDA gets pulled into. The biggest one is that suddenly Americans become aware that, or many Americans who were unaware become aware that there is a serious problem of hunger in America. The kind of narrative in mainstream America of the 1960s is that this is a moment of affluence. You know, we're in the Cold War and America is sort of projecting that capitalism is working. You have famous moments of this with like the kitchen debates with Nixon and Khrushchev, where Nixon is sort of saying, look at our kitchen, look at our supermarkets. This is showing that capitalism is working. And then suddenly in 1968, in the background, you have the civil rights movement arguing that this is not working for all Americans. Marion Wright, a civil rights activist, says to some senators, hey, we have serious problems of hunger. Come with me down to Mississippi and I'll show you. And this visit leads to an awareness among politicians. And then there is a documentary that brings it into the televisions of most Americans that actually there are serious hunger and a kind of people left behind in this affluence narrative. So that creates a kind of public discussion about what do we do about hunger and nutrition in America. When Nixon wins, one of the first things that he does is he says, we're going to have a White House conference on food, nutrition, and health. And he brings in this prominent nutritionist, Jean Meyer, a French-born, but at Harvard. And you start to get this effort to kind of reframe among the Nixon administration, let's reframe this hunger story in a way that fits with their agenda. But then you have also this sort of growing hunger lobby, a group of activists who are like seeing hunger as a way of getting Americans to care about the civil rights movement, basically saying it's not just about, you know, urban blacks and urban decay. Hunger cuts across a wide range of Americans, right? Including, you know, poor rural South and such. So hunger becomes this big issue. Meanwhile, the FDA, and this is where the food labeling story comes in. Meanwhile, the FDA is trying to hold a series of hearings to update its standards on special dietary foods. And it's gotten the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry angry with it because it's insisting on a label that was said, vitamins and minerals are supplied in abundant amounts by commonly available foods. Except for persons with special medical needs, there is no scientific basis for recommending routine use of dietary supplements. So this label, very quickly, as these hearings are going on, you have, you know, doctors being called in to testify on behalf of the FDA saying America's got an abundant supply of nutrition. But then you have people critical of this coming in saying, hey, we have a hunger in America scandal going on right now. There are people who are severely malnourished. Don't you look kind of foolish to be making this statement? And so suddenly the FDA's efforts to change the standards for special dietary foods, that becomes a big political liability. At the White House conference, you also have an interesting story, just an interesting story to tell, where many of the sort of prominent nutrition experts are being called in and are talking about what could be done. over the course of the conference and that kind of formal part of the conference, a clear message, you start to see a shift where it's saying, well, part of the problem is that we need to think about, and this fits with the Nixon administration's interest in characterizing this as a problem of education and personal responsibility. You also see a lot of interest in new diet foods and a clear consensus across the board of everyone saying we need to fix the food label because, you know, food labelings are just, the standard system is not working with all of these problems. But what makes it really interesting is that the hunger lobby, meanwhile, has kind of ransacked and captured the media by lots of colorful demonstration around the conference. And also they're really emphasizing that the experts are out of touch with the concerns that they're raising, you know, social justice concerns, poverty concerns. And so one of the things I like in this chapter is it's a kind of moment of reckoning between expert communities and this broader public concern. The kind of tragic outcome of the conference is that in the terms of food labeling, everyone's clearly unhappy with the food label, the standard system. They're clearly interested in the food label. But there's a kind of shifting away from the focus on poverty as the root of hunger and instead on food policy. Food policy in terms of which foods we should be getting them people to think about, how can we improve education? And so that's the kind of beginning of chapter four, which I think of, like I said, in the 1970s is really the turning point in FDA policy. And so chapter four is focused on that and is the heart of the book in this sense. So in chapter four, the FDA, 1970s, and especially 1973, a new group of people at the FDA come in, they say, we need to change our approach. And they introduce what they call voluntary nutrition labeling. And what they say is, okay, we have no legislative authority to require new food labels, but if you want to do non-standard foods that don't have a kind of fit standard or are they different than the standards we've been creating and requiring, we'll allow that without putting imitation on it if you then carry this nutrition information panel. And it's so kind of a compromise where they're saying you can do this, but it's not just a compromise. The FDA is actually in a way embracing a kind of market approach to handling all these new diet things. It publishes at the same time a standard for a product they call Melarine. And Melarine is an ice cream with the dairy animal fats removed and vegetable fats put in. And they use this as a kind of example of the kinds of foods industry could create and then put on their nutrition label and a health label. And so what they're doing is basically saying, all right, you can now create all these new foods and with the nutrition information label, and we're now going to require ingredients labeling on all foods too. Consumers can look at the label and make the decision for themselves. Are they interested in this new diet heart thesis? And therefore they can do that or not, in which case they can continue to, you know, be that ordinary consumer that we used to worry about. But it's not us telling you what to do. And so that's the kind of key. That's what I characterize as sort of the neoliberal approach. Or a market turn. It's this idea that we're not going to tell you what to eat, but we're going to make sure you have all the information you need so you can make that decision yourself. And we've had, that was 1973. And so we've had 50 years of nutrition labeling. That's, you know, this in 2023. And of course, in some ways, this looks like a kind of expansion of FDA powers, because it's creating these rules with no legislative backing. It's doing this in an environment in the 1970s that's very anti-government, and anti-government from both sides, not just the kind of right-wing attack that's trying to say, keep the government out of businesses. You have that. There's sort of this wonderful 1968 quote of Ronald Reagan as a California governor saying, keep your sticky labels off my supplements. Where he's sort of very much saying, keep the government out of our foods. But you also have on the left a kind of complaint about sort of backward, oppressive government institutions. The two best examples I like of this, one is not specific to food labeling, but it's just a powerful example of how food labeling is seen to be the solution. The FDA is exploring patient package inserts. So again, in theory, when you're given a drug from your doctor for prescription, the doctor is supposed to be the one making the risk calculation. But for drugs like birth control, they're getting attacked because it's being discovered that there are risks that women take with birth control that the FDA hadn't really considered. And also, feminists are arguing that doctors who are usually male don't understand women's needs. They don't understand the calculation about reproductive health. And so the FDA, the second product the FDA explores a patient package insert with, and the one that was the most important one for them, is by putting it in the birth control pill. That, again, the women now can read through this patient package insert all the information they need about the possible risks. They're not dependent on the doctor for that. So this is also happening with foods. You have Michael Jacobson publishes a book called Eater's Digest, where it's just a long diatribe about how the FDA isn't, the system is not meeting consumer interests. And he uses this phrase, silent labels, to talk about how a standard food doesn't have any health information or ingredient information. And so in a way, the FDA turning to the food label works because the idea that now in the market and consumers themselves, they can take down those decisions on themselves instead of being controlled in this kind of command and control form of the food standard system from before. And it's because both the left and the right are tired of government in this period.
Yeah, I think this is one of the really interesting insights of the book, is thinking about the ways that a particular model of expertise is breaking down and using the FDA and food labeling and drug labeling as a sort of way to tell that story. And that's, you know, a big part of the story that gets us into the 1990s, which is the subject of the last two chapters, which deal with the nutrition facts panel and the rejection of GMO labeling, the recognition of organic foods, et cetera. This is the era that you describe as the era of the FDA as an information broker rather than as a watchdog or as an agent. So in other words, this transformation that we've been talking about is sort of complete, right? Where now the job is to provide information rather than to promote public health. It sort of feels to me like one of those end user licensing agreements that's, you know, 3,000 pages long, and you just click yes at the bottom because it's too much information, right? I think we're sort of entering that phase of the relationship here. And this reflects and probably encourages changing conceptions of food and health. Food is, as you put it, becomes a product with interchangeable parts, emphasizing novelty and transcendental properties, which I thought, by the way, is a lovely way to put it. And health was redefined using in ways that then, you know, place the responsibility for risk determination on consumers more firmly even than before. And this is a model that you call informationism. And I guess at some level, it occurs to me that the narrative of the whole book is in some ways leading to, right, this rise of informationism as the current model that we are saddled with, if you'll allow me to editorialize a little bit. Is that a fair reading of the book? And can you tell us a little bit about chapters 5 and 6 along with that?
Yes, no, I definitely see us as being still in this age of information as the approach the FDA takes, although we may be transitioning out of it, so that's hard to say. But when I talk about the 1990s, and I have two chapters on this, and I'll explain why in a second, but the nutrition facts label really is the kind of triumphant moment of both the idea that information labeling is the way we should solve policy problems. In a way, the nutrition facts label is the FDA's attempt to standardize information in the market. And this is kind of ironic because, of course, before they were standardizing foods. Now, instead, they're focusing on the information panel and not on the foods themselves. And what happens in the 1990s is that, first of all, they have legislative authority now. Congress passes the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, and that's important to why the FDA is able to create the nutrition facts label. They require it on all foods, and this creates a lot of interesting challenges because food companies push back. You have Coca-Cola saying, no one's drinking a Coke to be healthy. Why do we have to have this label on there? Or does it make sense to have the label on, something like water, where it's 000, right? So you have that kind of response too. But the FDA, the people I spoke with, I interviewed people who worked at the FDA at the time, and they really see themselves as championing this consumer empowerment tool, right? This new label is going to empower consumers and bring clarity for consumers to all these questions about diet and health. Now, I challenge that a bit, in part by then having this next chapter where you're looking at other labeling approaches. I originally was going to end the book with the nutrition label as kind of the end of the story. And the problem I had with that, there were two problems I have with that. One is this is you have these other labeling things happening in the 1990s, which contradict the idea of the FDA as being pro-information. The main one I focus on is this, the genetically modified food label. So at the same time the FDA is pushing the nutrition facts panel, it is actively saying we are not going to label GMOs. It does this under a doctrine it calls substantial equivalence. It basically says there's no difference between ordinary foods and GMOs, and therefore it doesn't make sense to have labeling. Now, part of this is because, again, as I was saying, that these experts have their ideas of consumers. And in the 1980s, you get this concern about risk labels and sort of the irrational anxiety, risk-averse society that certain consumers are pushing. And so they're worried that the GM label is going to become a risk label, and they genuinely don't think it's meaningful. And so therefore they think that this is actually misinformation. And so with the GMO label, what you see is kind of the opposite of the nutrition facts label, a kind of effort to eventually accommodate a label with this label that we now have that was introduced in 2016, where it's clear the idea is the opposite. They want to make it harder for you to get a sense of what it means to be GM food because they don't want consumers thinking about that. So this is a point where I sort of say labels can also be a tool for obfuscation. They can make it, they can make information less clear to the consumer. The other thing is that I don't see this as a triumphant narrative where getting more information on the label results in more empowered consumers. And so when I, in the conclusion, talk about informationism, what I mean by that is at least two things. One is that we often see information as a kind of direct conduit into the food or into the product, and it's not. It always involves some kind of translation work by people about the properties of the food and how you represent that on the label as information. And that involves choices by experts about the design and also their kind of biases. So why are we thinking of food as nutrition and not, which is about the final product and these analytic chemists' idea of the final product versus how it's produced, right? You know, does it matter that it was produced in one kind of farming context versus another? Does it matter that some foods are highly processed and that make them very good for making things that look good on the nutrition facts panel, but it may not be the sort of wholesome, unprocessed food that some consumers are seeking that they think are healthy, right? They're not worried about the amount of different vitamins or the amount of particular fats. They're worried about how it's made. So that's sort of one problem that informationism is sort of hiding. It's sort of treating information like this non-problematic direct insight into the product instead of, you know, choices being made by these experts. The other is that it's treating information as enough of a solution to the problem about people's anxieties about food. If you simply give more information, consumers can simply make more choices. And that this is what consumers want. And I'm in the book, I'm really arguing against this idea of consumer empowerment. Labels don't free people from experts. They make them more dependent on experts. So the more of these informative labels you have, the more you depend on experts to make sure that what's on there is correct, making decisions about what should or should not go on there. And so it's a, this is a history of more and more experts getting pulled into this sort of package tool. And ironically, and this is where I end the book, it's not making consumers happier about where their food is coming from. And here's where I draw on sort of those sociologists who work on trust point out over and over again that trust is not about proof, or at least it's not only about proof. You know, show me that the food is safe. And the label is trying to answer that idea. But actually, a lot of times, trust is relational. It's about who I'm talking with. And So you have this problem that runs throughout the book where we no longer know who's producing our foods. And so how do you build that kind of trust in who's producing the foods? And giving more and more information isn't answering that question. So kind of the conclusion in the book is that we need to focus on improving our, civic associations, public institutions, and their efforts to build trust in our food, not just provide more information.
Yeah, I think this is a really important insight that, you're examining the way that one earlier system of conception of expertise sort of falls apart, and that, again, the one that replaces it doesn't make people happy either. And you still have this problem of, who's experts and for whom, and you have the problem of, by necessity, I guess, only partial information for whole products and whole systems, right? There's no way to have complete and total information. And without that, you're never going to have the kind of satisfaction and trust that you would need. So I think that was one of the things that really sort of struck me coming out of this, that, it comes down to those two things that you just mentioned, these questions of risk and trust and how we deal with them as a society. I wanted to sort of end on that note, because I think it's a really sort of powerful summation of what you're doing in the book, and to thank you for taking the time to talk with us about it, to hope that we'll have you back here sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this, and I really hope people will be interested in the book and check it out.
Excellent. Thank you.